Over the years, I've sat down with lots of terrorists. The accused kind, the convicted kind, and those who fall somewhere in between. I'd been NPR's counterterrorism correspondent for 10 years, and I'd been chasing a guy named Abdullahi Yusuf for 2. I finally caught him.
Are you scared of going to prison?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go to prison. No one wants to go to prison. I don't want to go back to jail even now, so, yeah.
And a lot of the time, the people I sat across from were really young, like in their teens or early 20s. And those cases were hard. I found myself consoling tearful moms and trying to make sense of the decisions their kids had made.
The detective says they received a call that I was preparing to attack Plymouth White Marsh High School.
Wow, someone from our school, like, committed suicide and now they're gone.
Even at points where I'd hated myself and I'd gone to sleep, angry at who I'd become, I still kept playing.
Everyone makes bad decisions, but I think we can all agree adolescents tend to make more of them. In the past 5 years, scientists have started to study the adolescent brain in new and creative ways, and they're starting to link scans of the brain with their actual behavior. Sample sizes are small and findings are preliminary, but what they're discovering may take some of the mystery out of those years between 13 and 24. I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and this is What Were You Thinking? A show in which we look at kids' decisions, study their developing brains, and try to figure out what we might be able to do to help them choose more wisely. The idea is to understand in a very fundamental way what they were thinking. In this episode, Abdullahi's story starts on a Friday night in Burnsville, Minnesota, and he was suited up and on the offensive line. Abdullahi Yusuf played wide receiver for the Burnsville High School Blaze.
It was hard, and you overcame a lot, and it pushed you to your limits, and you found out what you were made of. You know, football teaches you lessons, I think.
It teaches you about heart and teamwork and feeling a part of something bigger than yourself.
But when it's over, you're like, oh my gosh, it's over. What am I going to do after school now?
The season ended with a banquet.
Coach told us to dress up. I was wearing a shirt, a tie, and some dress pants.
If you've ever played a team sport, you remember what the speeches at those banquets were like.
I had the opportunity to meet a lot of great people in my life. But one thing that I've noticed in my 18 years of living is that people are in a constant search for belonging.
Yeah, it was a good ending for the season.
Was that sad?
Yeah, very.
He was sad because something that defined him just vanished.
We were called like the Band of Brothers. We had shirts that said Burnsville Football, Band of Brothers. So that was pretty cool.
And it was at that moment, when football was over, when the guys on the team began drifting away.
I just started hanging out with people who look like me again, and people who I've had more in common with.
Abdullahi has many identities.
His aunt, Hamdi Huddle, has watched him struggle with this for years.
I am bold. I am jolly.
Some of them are like being black.
I am black. I am this. I am that.
Being Muslim. Being Somali.
I am labeled. I am Somali.
Being a first-generation immigrant.
I am a hoodlum. I am Muslim. I am an alleged terrorist. I am not sure how that makes me feel.
Today you're going to hear from a teenager who went from football player to terrorist recruit to years in jail. And he'll lay out how it happened, and his story might change the way you think about these American kids who get seduced by terrorist groups. This is the first time Abdullahi Yusuf has ever spoken about this publicly, and what he has to say may surprise you, because he didn't try to go to Syria to fight with ISIS because he hated America, or because he believed in violent extremism. Instead, what drove him, and what drives many of the American teenagers who have tried to join the group, is a very teenage need to belong to something, to find a purpose. And experts are starting to believe that this kind of adolescent decision-making may have as much to do with nature as nurture. The adolescent brain may actually be wired, at least temporarily, to make this kind of poor decision.
In some ways, one of the most striking things, one of the most puzzling things about adolescence and the age span that you're defining it in is that it's simultaneously the time of life when somebody is most likely to mug an elderly woman or commit some horrible social sort of inappropriate behavior. And it's also the most likely time of life where you decide to devote yourself to the, like, lessening the pains in the world and everything in between.
Abdullahi says if he had to trace back how he ended up becoming an alleged terrorist, it probably began in a small way in a high school social studies class his senior year. A teacher asked him to do a very simple thing, to study a country.
We got assigned the countries, and I got Syria. Like, make a presentation, make a poster. The first thing I saw was the embargoes the U.S. was placing on Syria. And then I went on YouTube, and then I typed in Syria, and then right away I saw, like, civil war and stuff like that. I'm like, this might be interesting. That's around the time that media coverage in the U.S. here was starting to pick up about what the U.S. should do.
There is breaking news now from the war in Syria.
Two battle bombs filled with glory.
Destruction, mass killing.
The Syrian government was responsible for this attack on its own people.
I knew there was something that needed to be done, but I didn't know what I could do. And I knew it was wrong. The way things were going, I thought the U.S. would go into Syria at the time.
But the U.S. didn't go in. And as Abdullahi spent every spare moment Googling and watching YouTube videos on Syria, it became more than a project.
It became a hobby, you know, keeping up with what was going on there.
So it's late 2013. Football is over. Abdullahi is working on that Syria assignment, and he starts testing limits, getting into trouble.
Skipping school, smoking pot, stealing cars, got caught sometimes, didn't get caught sometimes.
And his parents were worried. So they transferred him out of Burnsville to an all-Somali school. And then, when his behavior doesn't improve, to another school. And then again a third time, to a high school that's basically for kids who are trying to get just enough credits to graduate. Abdullahi's young auntie, Hamdi, said the family just chalked it up to a phase.
Even if he, like, did all these things, Abdullahi was such a happy person. Like, it was kind of, like, part of his personality. Like, you knew that he didn't mean to, like, upset anybody. He was just having fun. He was like a typical teenager. We felt like he'll just grow out of it.
What if the reason why young people made poor decisions wasn't just because they were rebellious? What if it actually had something to do with the brain as it develops between the ages of 13 and 24?
People sometimes point to the prefrontal cortex and say, well, it's not mature enough. The story is a little more complicated than that. You can show that their prefrontal cortex is actually quite capable of adult-like decision-making and even adult-like reasoning in all sorts of ways.
Dan Siegel wrote a best-selling book about the teenage brain, and he says to understand crazy youthful decision-making, you have to understand the brain during adolescence. For one thing, the architecture of the brain, the way it's wired, is changing. The best way to think about this remodeling is that the adolescent brain is in the process of tossing things it doesn't need. Brain connections that are essential during childhood, like the instinct to suckle or reaching for your mother's hand before crossing the street, those are stripped away because they're no longer needed.
It's one of the most clever things evolution has ever come up with brain development, which is, if anything, the tendency is that you overproduce neurons by vast numbers and you overproduce connections. And what brain development is about then is pruning away the unessential ones.
Here's how Robert Sapolsky, a professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University, explains it.
So that by age 15, the, like, deeply committed, what's the theme song to the Teletubbies circuit that dominated your life when you were three, has sort of gone back burner. In a lot of ways, what adolescent brain development is about is leaner, meaner, more efficient, fewer circuits.
The second thing going on in the brain that might have played a role in Abdullahi's story has to do with a small part about the size of your thumb that's tucked away between the frontal and temporal lobes. It's called the insula. And researchers believe that during adolescence, it may shift into overdrive. Essentially, it becomes, like a lot of teenagers, oversensitive.
It's spectacular when you see somebody on fire about some injustice that they've got to go take care of, and that wonderful sort of adolescent optimism that they're going to be able to do it. And like, all I can think of there at that point is like, damn, it used to be so easy to be that way. Because part of what an adult frontal cortex does is maybe it makes you a little bit more like reasonable in coming up with the right intervention and better. But what it's mostly good for is coming up with a way for you to say, hey, that's not my problem, or somebody else will take care of it, or oops, I got something else to worry about, and you move on.
Everything started changing for Abdullahi when he rediscovered an old friend of his, a kid named Hanad Mohallam.
We spent a lot of time at each other's houses. We took ACT prep together, tried to go to driving school together. He got kicked out of that, though. He was being loud.
Hanad was following events in Syria, too, and he had come to hate the Syrian regime.
He showed me on his phone, and he was talking about a specific video of a guy being told to kiss Bashar al-Assad's picture, and he refused, and soldiers were kicking him in his mouth and stuff like that. I thought he was at the same point as me, you know, just we're keeping up with this current event, you know. I was just wondering what would happen to those people, you know.
If we want to understand what might motivate two young men from the Midwest to leave the U.S. and fight in a civil war half a world away, we need to know that it wasn't just their hearts that were going out to the people of Syria. Their heads may have also played a role. And in particular, that part of the brain we mentioned before, the insula. Daniel Siegel explains.
The insula feeds into an area where self-awareness is generated, which is right next to an area for other awareness. These are the neurobiological paths of empathy. And amazingly, even morality is mediated in an adjacent area as well. So as you gain a sense of what's going on in someone else, what's going on inside yourself, you also have a sense of being a part of a larger whole.
Researchers say those butterflies you feel in your stomach when you see someone you love, or that sadness you might feel when you see the suffering of war, may all have a connection to the insula. And we bring this up to raise the possibility that maybe Abdullahi was so affected by the civil war in Syria, not because of some great religious conviction, but because of his hyped-up adolescent insula. And when you're emotional, consequences are the last thing you think about.
This fevered desire to do something to change that, this typical sort of adolescent omnipresent sense that you personally are going to be able to transform the world and are immortal in the process. And what's often the case is some pretty poor, misguided judgment along the way.
This was like, get up off your butt, and if you don't like it, go do something about it.
The Americans who were rushing off to join Al-Qaeda or its affiliated groups tended to be in their mid to late 20s. But ISIS recruits in the U.S., they tend to be teenagers or in their early 20s. Everything changed for Abdullahi one evening when he was playing basketball with Hanad.
And he's like, I have something to talk to you about. It's really something important. And I just sort of blew him off because I'm around the guy all the time. So if he had something to say, he could say it to me later. That was my last night seeing him.
Hanada disappeared, and for some reason, Abdullahi had a sneaking suspicion he knew where he'd gone.
His passport's missing, and I knew right then and there that he went over to go fight in Syria.
Just a day after Hanad disappeared, a guy named Gulid Omar invited Abdullahi out for dinner. Gulid was older and very popular at school.
We knew each other, but we never hung out. I knew he was very outspoken on social media, had a lot of followers, very opinionated, charismatic, you know, had a lot of friends, you know.
If your parents had known that you were hanging out with Gulid Omar, how would they have felt about that?
If they knew the Gulid Omar now, like they know now, they wouldn't let me anywhere near him. We'd probably move to North Dakota or something.
But they didn't know. In fact, they had no idea.
So we went out to eat at this Somali restaurant, and we're talking about Hanad and why he's missing and that he may be in Syria right now.
More and more guys started showing up at the restaurant, like ghosts melting through a wall. Young Somalis from the neighborhood began showing up unexpectedly. They'd squeeze in next to each other, drag tables over to join the discussion. Dinner with Omar became a party.
A lot of people I knew before, mostly religious young Somali people. That night, you know, it felt like they were welcoming me into something.
Let's pause for a minute for a little science. Dan Siegel from UCLA will tell you that Abdullahi's desire to be with all these guys can in part be explained by biology.
When you look at how, let's say, an 8-year-old differs from a 15-year-old, what you notice is that there's a drive for an 8-year-old to, you know, be with caregivers like parents and seek comfort from them. But for the 15-year-old, usually there's a drive to be with peers.
So adolescents may not just want to hang out with friends. Their brains may be wired to tell them that they have to be, even if they suspect those friends aren't good for them. And for Abdullahi, all these guys he was hanging out with, not just football players like before, but now Somalis, just like him, were raising questions about being Muslim in America that he'd been thinking about privately for some time.
When I used to stand up in class for the Pledge of Allegiance or whatever, and I'd feel like, am I American? Do I fit in? Or whatever, and I'd see other kids of my race, my religion, or whatever, they'd sit, you know, and it's like, what's going on? Are we different? A lot of questions about identity, and I didn't see myself as American before.
You know, if you're feeling alienated in a culture, if you feel like you don't belong, if there aren't opportunities in the community for you to feel membership that has meaning to you, then you can understand how an adolescent would be especially vulnerable to needing that kind of connection as they push away from their family.
After that dinner with Gulid Omar and his new friends, that very night, Abdullahi was introduced to videos that featured young men, just like him, who had become noble soldiers on the fields of battle. He and his friends went onto a special ISIS YouTube channel and began watching videos that looked like a cross between a Vin Diesel movie and a video game. There were slow-motion shots of young men firing automatic weapons and blowing stuff up.
We're all, like, in a circle, you know? We're near each other and we're talking.
And they're passing cell phones and tablets around. Look at this one, someone would say. What about that one, said another.
I was mesmerized, you know, like, I didn't even know they existed. So it was like, if you don't like it, go do something about it. And here's why you should go do something about it. And, you know, it's just check, 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 check. That's me, that's me, that's me, that's me. And, you know, sign me up.
It was weeks before it became clear to Abdullahi that his new group of friends knew exactly where Hanad had gone.
He's chasing heaven, you know. Don't worry about him. At the time, I thought he did the right thing, so kept it close to his vest, you know, something he truly believed in, something he really wanted, and he did it. I think you'd have a hard time talking me out of what I believed in at the time. We're the ones doing something noble. And I didn't see it as against, like, U.S. foreign policy or anything. You know, I thought, you know, what was going on there was bad. So I thought I was provided an answer by him leaving.
Abdullahi was ready to do anything for them. And one afternoon, Gulid put that to the test.
Abdullahi, we're, like, on a long and hard journey. We're going to go to Syria and fight. You can join us if you want to, but if not, if you turn around and walk away right now, there's no hard feelings. And I said, sign me up, you know, I'm on board.
Were you worried about losing your new friends?
Yeah. I felt a void with Hanad leaving. It quickly got filled by this group. One thing they say is hesitation to them means that you're not a true believer. So if you get the message and it resonates with you and you sit back and lollygag, you know, you're not on the right path. So I think that
did you just use the word lollygag?
Yeah. doesn't that mean like sit around?
No, you're exactly right. It's a great word.
Yeah.
So if you lollygag, then you're not a true believer.
Yeah.
While Abdullahi realizes now that lollygagging has nothing to do with being a true believer, at the time he didn't, which fits perfectly into the pattern of radicalization in this country. It happens among friends, far from the mosque, almost removed from the context of religion. This is about being heroic, saving innocent women and children, being a man. One recruiter I talked to in London years ago said radicalizing a young Muslim was like picking up a girl at a nightclub. If she gives you her number, you take her somewhere else so you can be alone with her and control the situation. And the guys with Abdullahi, they were like that. They were peeling Abdullahi off from the rest of his friends, the football team, his parents, his family.
I thought they were courageous, and I thought they were standing up for what they believed in. You know, there's risk-taking involved in that. You had to stand up for what you believed in.
So all this was happening in the spring of 2014, and the timing is important because ISIS was different then than it is now. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi hadn't yet declared himself the leader of the Islamic State. The group hadn't beheaded journalists. And Mosul, a major city that ISIS took over in Iraq, wasn't yet under their control.
They were pretty much going off the Assad regime, you know. We're the ones being oppressed, you know. Come help us, you know. We're the ones doing something noble.
So law enforcement jumps to the conclusion that when you want to join ISIS, you mm-hmm. might possibly want to come back here and attack. Was that something you guys ever talked about?
Never. I was told that if I got over there, to tear my passport out, not give my passport, hand my passport over to ISIS or whatever, just in case they wanted me to come back and do something here.
Wow.
ISIS makes Syria travel easy.
Well, they basically have facilitators who are engaging with them in English.
Kareem Shura is one of the guys I used to talk to when I was covering terrorism.
Sometimes they use other languages, Western European languages, operating almost as travel agents.
He's from the Department of Homeland Security, and he's seen and heard these ISIS facilitators at work.
Individuals even asked, are there clean bathrooms? And they'd answer them, well, yes, but they don't clean themselves. Oftentimes they'll ask what kind of clothes to bring, and they'll say, well, bring North Face because it's a good quality brand, or what type of boots to wear, and they'll recommend certain boots to wear. It's at that level of detail of how to prepare for the trip and what to take with them.
Sometimes these agents are perfect strangers, but more often they're people who have left for Syria and then text their friends back home. And that's how it was for Guled and the guys in Minnesota. Their ISIS travel agent was someone they knew. It was none other than Hanad Mohallam.
I was glad he was alive. I was glad he was talking to me. He apologized for not telling me. He talked about what was going on for him over there. He talked about how training camp was hard, and for security reasons he couldn't say too much, he said.
By then, Abdullahi was spending all his time with Guled and the group.
I would get up in the morning, and my dad would drop me off at school.
They watched videos.
Around that time, I was coming home late at night, you know.
They talked about Assad and the atrocities going on in Syria.
Hang out late night at the mosques or the parks or whatever, driving around.
And Abdullahi became convinced he didn't have to sit on the sidelines.
My parents, they didn't know their son was being recruited to go to Syria. Fighting was the answer, I guess.
Did it occur to you that this would change your life?
Didn't even occur to me.
And Sapolsky says that the fact that all this happened at the hands of young people who were just slightly older than Abdullahi shouldn't be a surprise.
If you are a young primate, human or otherwise, what you do if you're a baboon or a young chimp or a young human for 99% of human history, you're spending all day long hanging out with, like, second cousins and hanger-ons, and where you're all like in a similar age range, and what you're mostly doing is learning from the kids who are slightly older than you.
There was an interesting experiment that looked at this kind of peer influence back in the 1930s. It was done by a comparative psychologist named Winthrop Niles Kellogg. He decided to rear a baby chimp named Gula alongside his own infant son, Donald.
The scientific expectation of the time was this was going to provide a fantastic model to this young chimp who was going to get all sorts of acculturation from how the young human was growing up, and we would see this great untapped potential for chimps to take on all sorts of human behaviors. And instead, they had to stop the experiment after a while because their kid was acting more and more like a chimp.
As it turns out, Dr. Cebulski says, Gula's age was his big advantage.
The chimp was a little bit older and certainly more physically adept and certainly doing a lot cooler stuff than the human kid could do, like climbing up all over things and, you know, chewing through stuff. And who could resist that if a slightly older quasi-peer is doing all this stuff? And, like, no wonder the kid wound up more like a chimp rather than the other way around.
And there was something else. Research has shown that teens are much more likely to take risks in the presence of other teens. The drive to belong is that strong. So being part of the group led by Gulad Omar only made Abdullahi's poor judgment that much worse, and his adolescent brain didn't even consider what that would mean. Once Abdullahi had made his decision, everything was on fast forward. He opened a bank account, bought luggage, booked tickets to Istanbul.
I thought I found my calling.
That night, before he left, Abdullahi couldn't sleep.
I was nervous, you know. It's my last day. It's my family last day in America. Last day is life as I knew it, right?
He climbed into the car with his dad, just like he did every morning.
As when he pulls up to the school, I give him a hug, say goodbye. He thought that was strange because, I don't know, I wasn't giving him hugs, you know, before.
And what made you want to give him a hug?
This is my last time seeing my dad, you know. I wanted a good memory.
You didn't expect yourself to do that?
No.
Abdullahi waves the last time. He waits a beat and watches his dad drive away. Minutes later, a car pulls up in front of the school, and Abdullahi climbs in.
I get to the airport.
And were you nervous?
Very nervous. This is it. I'm doing it finally. No turning back now.
That feeling Abdullahi had at the airport, that heart-in-your-throat decision about whether you're doing the right thing, has been repeated across the country. Airports have become a different kind of crime scene, a place where kids like Abdullahi cross the line. In the time it takes them to make a few short steps toward an airplane door, they go from motivated adolescent to terrorist recruit. Abdullahi finds his departure gate, and he waits for the gate agent to call his boarding group. He's 10 feet from the door, 6 feet, and then
the FBI came and said, Abdullahi, we need to talk to you. And they're like, you're not flying today. And I said, that's not fair. And they're like, well, we can have this discussion somewhere else, you know, somewhere more private. So we go to a different part of the airport. I was being a pain in the ass. We talked about this, what to say if you were stopped, you know. They asked me where I'm going, and I say, Istanbul for vacation. They asked me if my parents know I'm here, and I asked them if their parents know they're here. They asked me if I would mind if they went and talked to my parents.
And then what did you think?
I'm fucked.
He was right. His parents were beside themselves. In their wildest dreams, they never expected Abdullahi to do something like this. Even Abdullahi didn't fully appreciate what he had done. He didn't realize that by just attempting to fly to Syria to join ISIS, he could end up in prison, possibly for decades.
I had an attorney, and he was talking about conspiracy to commit murder and conspiring to provide material support and stuff like that. And I'm like, holy crap, I'm guilty of what he's talking about, you know? So.
And was that the first time it occurred to you that you were guilty of that?
Yeah.
Abdullahi went to jail, and then something completely unexpected happened. Something that in all my years of covering terrorism, I've never seen before. the judge asked some local counselors to talk to Abdullahi to figure out if he'd just made a youthful mistake or whether he was a terrorist in the making. This was the first time I'd ever seen a judge entertain the possibility that a wannabe jihadi could be saved. And if it worked, it could fundamentally change the way the U.S. deals with young people like Abdullahi in the future. Lots of other countries try to re-educate young people who join terrorist groups, but the results have been mixed. By the time I sat down with Abdullahi, he'd been in jail for 2 years. He had pleaded guilty to terrorism charges and was awaiting sentencing. He faced as much as 20 years in prison for a charge that sounded more serious than Abdullahi had ever imagined.
Conspiracy to provide material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization.
And he began adapting to life in jail.
It's rough, but there's good and bad, I guess.
And the good included this person.
And I walked into this room, and this tall, handsome kid stands up. And I'm like, what? That's a good-looking guy. What are you doing? And he was so polite and respectful. Like, I was taken back by that. And I was like, wait, this can't be the kid.
Ahmed Amin is a high school teacher who came in to help talk to Abdullahi to try to understand why he decided to join ISIS. He was working with Mary McKinley. She's the executive director of a nonprofit called Heartland Democracy.
And we would talk about the two movies that could be made about him.
Mary was concerned Abdullahi would try to con her.
And one was that he went from this to the Yale Law School and then he becomes a professor in this kind of tale. And the other one was the long con. Ooh, got my parents, then I got the lawyers, and then I got this organization, and then the judge, you know, and I said, you know, actually that's a more interesting movie. And we would talk about sort of different versions of people that were like that.
Everyone is hoping Abdullahi ends up starring in the first movie, The Redemption Tale.
Have you read Foucault?
Yeah, I have. Okay. Do you like Foucault?
Yeah.
And what do you like about him?
Just detail, right? Reading about being incarcerated while incarcerated is very...
Did he get it right?
Yeah.
He said he did like to read. He didn't read as much as he... you know, kind of probably should. And I said, you know, you're going to be in jail. You're going to have a lot of time on your hands.
And here's where something miraculous happens. Mary and Ahmed's program was tapping into the very thing that research suggests may help prevent adolescents from making these kinds of decisions they regret. By making him read critically and think critically, they were developing very specific parts of his brain.
There are studies about the power of reading.
Neurobiologist Dan Siegel says getting someone to read critically and closely can actually change the brain. Remember that part of the brain that processes emotion and empathy, the insula? Siegel says that part of the brain can actually change and grow.
Studies suggest that the insula is very responsive to training. And literally, you can show this that even after a day-long retreat of self-reflective practice, the insula actually gets thicker.
Here's Dan Siegel explaining how it works.
When you have active reading, and what I mean by that is not just passively taking in information, but engaging with the information that's coming in and doing self-reflection, then it's an opportunity to enhance your self-understanding. And those different ways of developing more self-awareness and critical thinking at the same time that allows you, in fact, to wait before you respond, to choose more wisely and more skillfully.
Abdullahi says the decision to join the group in their Syria project was instantaneous.
There was, like, no hesitation on my part. It just happened like that.
Dan Siegel believes you can slow down that decision process, essentially make adolescents more thoughtful.
With writing in a journal, with self-reflection, with all sorts of processes that encourage an interior narrative, a kind of way you observe, witness, and narrate your experience so you can say, yes, I have an impulse to join that group, but no, I won't, because I have an internal guide pointing me in a different direction.
Okay, so you totally don't want to read a poem, so, or do you?
Do you have a title? Yeah, I am human. I have to start every sentence with I am. So it goes, I am an alleged terrorist. I am not sure how that makes me feel. I throw a fit. I am currently drinking a Sierra Mist. I am in a hole. I am sure it'll take quite a toll. I am thankful I am whole. I am bold. I am labeled. I am Somali. I am jolly. I am a hoodlum. I am Muslim. I am black. I am this. I am that. I am sure of one thing for a fact. I am a human. So I just try to make stuff rhyme, so.
To get Abdullahi to the point of that kind of self-reflection, Mary put together a reading program.
A Martin Luther King book, a Malcolm X book, A Raisin in the Sun. You know, I thought it was more academic than anything. But, you know, and I wasn't big on school, so.
And he began with
the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Why'd you do that one first?
Because I related to him the most. He was talking about how his shift from radical, like, nation Islam, black extremist, black nationalism to regular Sunni Islam. And then I'm like, this sounds, it's like in my backyard, sort of. And Malcolm X was in prison for a long time. So, I mean, almost 10 years. So I think that appealed to me. So I think that's why I write that one. But that book, like, really had an impact on me.
He's just being allowed to lead this very unexamined life.
Again, Abdullahi's counselor, Ahmed Amin.
And then, you know, sort of if that's how you exist, then when you are introduced to certain propaganda, then you're more likely to fall into it. Because you're not thinking, you're not critical. You just accept things as they are and you believe it.
I didn't know everything about what I signed up for. There's answers to the questions I had. But I guess it was.
Can you tell me what the questions are?
Like, is what's going on there wrong or right? Or about me, like my identity here in America? Do I fit in here? Do I belong here? Or like, what are my prospects here? Like, where do I see myself? You know, do I don't feel like I'm American, you know? Am I Muslim? Am I Somali?
What's ISIS? What's jihad? I mean, it's kind of weird to think that he never really had those conversations before he made the decision to join ISIS.
I mean, in a lot of ways, that's how he got caught, because he can't fake. But it also leaves him open to admit to himself, wow, I just really had that wrong.
You have to do like an intelligent search for the truth, or else ISIS will appeal to you. And you'll think what they're saying is right, but in reality it's wrong.
So is Abdullahi's change of heart because critical thinking helped develop the insula in his brain, or is something else going on? Dr. Sapolsky says while Abdullahi's insula may have changed, you can't discount that time allowed the rest of his teenage brain to make some changes too.
What would one want an adolescent brain to be doing more of? And the obvious answer is discriminating, which is something very different from saying, ooh, a stronger frontal cortex.
Abdullahi was awaiting sentencing in jail for 2 years. That's 2 years in which his brain was busy developing, busy becoming an optimal adult brain. His prefrontal cortex wasn't getting any bigger. It reached full size years ago. But what it might have been doing is getting better.
A lot of what the frontal cortex is doing is trying to get there just in time to whisper into the ear of those striatal or amygdala-like neurons, wait a second, is this really, really such a good idea? Can we stop for a second and rethink this?
It's nearly impossible to tell which explanation is the correct one. In the end, Dan Siegel says the idea behind Abdullahi's rehabilitation program was really to get him to stop for a minute and think, to provide a moment of reflection.
A space between impulse and action that allows you, in fact, to wait before you respond.
And clearly, for whatever reason, that seems to have happened. The last time I spoke with Abdullahi was just 2 days before he was supposed to face a judge and find out how long he'd be in prison, paying for his adolescent mistake.
Are you scared of going to prison?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go to prison. No one wants to go to prison. I don't want to go back to jail even now, so, yeah.
How are you sort of mentally preparing yourself for that?
Well, it's not the end of the world, right? I think that I can do productive things in prison. I don't have to sit on my hands and lollygag, you know? So, yeah, it's not the end of the world. Just take advantage of the time I have there and, you know, better myself even more, make more progress, you know? So, that's how I see it. I'm not out of the woods yet.
So, it's sentencing day. I'm walking into the federal courthouse in Minneapolis now on South 4th Street. And Abdullahi Yusuf has been waiting 2 years for this day. And Department of Justice has recommended that he get at least 42 months. The question is whether or not he gets that or less or more, which is a real possibility. The judge could give him more. So we're all waiting to see.
So all this is happening at the end of 2016. President Trump has already won the election, but he hasn't come into office yet. And given all the talk during the campaign of a Muslim ban, it seemed pretty dire for Abdullahi. Abdullahi's family and I all ended up waiting in line together to go up to the courtroom.
Did you sleep last night? No, any of us.
The judge in the case, Michael Davis, was going to announce all the sentences for all the guys in the group at the same time. A handful had pleaded guilty, like Abdullahi, and others, like Guled Omar, had gone to trial, and a jury had found them guilty. Abdullahi was the only one in the jihadi rehab program, and the first one to get sentenced. Judge Davis began by playing these ISIS videos in the courtroom. He asked Abdullahi if these violent videos were what he had been watching. He asked about his counseling program, and whether he understood what he had done wrong. And then the judge sighed and said, "I just don't see how prison will help this boy." And he declared a sentence no one was expecting. 20 years supervised release. Abdullahi became the first terrorism defendant in the U.S. to avoid prison. The judge's decision meant Abdullahi would move from county jail to a halfway house where he'd continue his counseling. His family hadn't fully processed what had happened. They invited me into the room where they had gathered, and the mood had changed.
I wish we had tea that we could all celebrate with. Right?
And someone handed me a camera to take a picture.
Here.
The world works in mysterious ways, let me tell you.
Very few of these terrorism stories have happy endings. Guled Omar, the guy who recruited Abdullahi, was sentenced to 35 years. Most of the other guys in the group, there were 10 arrested in all, they got long sentences too. Remember Hanad, Abdullahi's best friend? He was killed in Syria.
Everyone who was left over there, it's only sad stories, you know. It's not, you don't hear any. I guarantee you everyone who went there regrets it.
The last time I talked to him, Abdullahi was trying to move forward.
When I think of, like, doing something, I wanted to do something that I helped people, and I want to go to school, you know, academia.
And I asked him one other question about that class assignment that got so much of this going in the first place.
Have you ever thought how different your life would be if you got, like, Tonga or Fiji or, yeah, like, why Sweden?
Why can't I get New Zealand or something, right?
In our next episode, we meet a computer genius who gets famous on the internet, but not for the reason you may think.
All along, it was because I was, you know, hacking their computers.
That's next time on What Were You Thinking? This episode of What Were You Thinking was reported by me, Dina Temple-Raston, and produced by Anna Adlerstein and Caitlin Pierce. Our editor is Martha Little, sound design and mixing by Version Control, and fact-checking by Darren Ancrum. Production help from Madeline Orozco. I'm the executive producer with Martha Little. This is Audible. We all know that you can create a lot of mischief on the internet. Can you introduce yourself?
My name's Ryan Green. I am a serial entrepreneur.
This is the first time Ryan has ever spoken publicly about how he became one of the most renowned figures in the shadiest part of the internet.
Would you call yourself a hacker?
Retired hacker. Yeah, retired hacker, I guess.
And he's from a place, it's safe to say, you wouldn't generally associate with hacking.
We live so far out in the country, you couldn't get cable. Never had cable TV growing up. I didn't watch TV, period. Like, we had like 3, 6, and 12. You know, there might have been like Friday nights I would watch like, I think it was called Dallas.
Ryan grew up in a tiny unincorporated town in western Kentucky called Smithland, population 400, where his father owned the local gas station.
Which was technically my first job, you know, sitting there pumping gas on Saturdays.
And did it have like a little store attached, or was it just like an old-fashioned gas station?
It was just an old-fashioned gas station, had an old rundown chair and a desk sitting in the, and some candy bars and soft drinks.
If we've learned anything in recent years, it's that hackers can be dangerous. They can interfere in national elections, create fake news, and devastate giant corporations. And they can hide in plain sight, whether it's in a basement in Moscow or a couple of miles from an old-fashioned gas station in Smithland, Kentucky. And Ryan Green's big hack, the thing that made him famous, involved a secret place online where computer geeks from around the world could compare notes, swap code, and build enormous armies of computers to send spam and attack servers. When it was all said and done, when law enforcement officials took it down, they called its members
the collection of some of the most notorious cyber criminals in the world.
And where did Ryan Green fit in? Well, he spent most of his 20s trying to perfect it. I'm Dina Temple Raston, and this is What Were You Thinking? A show about young people and their decisions.
The detective says they received a call that I was preparing to attack Plymouth White Marsh High School.
Wow, someone from our school, like, committed suicide, and now they're gone.
We're gonna go to Syria and fight. You can join us if you want to.
Even at points where I'd hated myself and I'd gone to sleep, angry at who I'd become, I still kept playing.
We tell their stories, explain how the latest brain science is changing the way we understand adolescent choices, and then we go around the world to look at new and innovative programs meant to prevent them from making those bad decisions in the first place. And we're starting today with a computer you've probably never actually seen.
So this is a Commodore 64?
Yeah, old Commodore.
That was Ryan's first computer. And when he got it, the dopamine system in his brain may have sounded a little like this. We've all heard of dopamine, the chemical we most associate with the brain's reward system. It plays a role in motor commands, and it also plays an integral part in the choices we make because it helps the brain weigh the costs and benefits of decisions. Researchers have discovered that even the slightest imbalance in its levels can trigger a host of problems, from gambling to, yes, hacking. And that sound you heard before? That is the sound of individual dopamine neurons actually firing in the brain. Live dopamine cells in action. Although in this case, they aren't in Ryan's brain. They're in the brain of a big white adolescent rat.
May I ask you to cover me?
Absolutely. Okay.
That rat belongs to neuroscientist Beta Mogadev.
Anything from outside, street, lab, to the animal facility, because we want to make sure they're happy and healthy.
Mogadev is in charge of the Department of Behavioral Neuroscience at Oregon Health and Science University, and her specialty is understanding the role dopamine plays in the way adolescents make decisions. She's been studying the adolescent brain for years.
As a scientist, I'm interested in understanding why motivated behavior is different in adolescents versus adults. What is it about the neurons that are encoding this behavior that's different in adolescents?
And she's convinced that there's something in the adolescent brain that explains why those years between the ages of 13 and 24 are a time of such emotional upheaval. Why is it that young people have such a huge propensity for drug and gaming addictions, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and suicide. Beata Mogadem is so focused on this because she thinks that the key to preventing these kinds of disorders lies in the dopamine reward system.
We cannot stop preventing them unless we really understand why the adolescent brain is dynamically different from adult brains.
The easiest way to understand dopamine is to know that it acts as a messenger between cells in the brain. And among other things, it makes you feel good when it's released. So that means that dopamine actually motivates behavior. Mogadem and the researchers who work with her measured the amount of dopamine in the brain to get a better idea of how it works and what it does. It turns out if you measure the electrical charge dopamine gives off when it's oxidized, you can work out precisely how much dopamine is there.
I actually started graduate school as a chemist, biochemist. I was really interested in methods that allowed us to measure small levels of some chemicals that happen to be in the brain. And by small, I mean a handful of molecules, a fraction of what a dust particle weighs. My dissertation work involved developing the technique that allowed us to measure dopamine in the brain.
Studying levels of dopamine in the brain has led researchers like Beata to believe that having just the right amount of dopamine at the right time, in the right place, is critical to normal human function. Studies suggest that ADHD, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, and even binge eating are related to problems with dopamine. In fact, too much dopamine in the wrong part of your brain is linked to psychosis, and too little dopamine can make you look for ways to increase it. And one way to increase it is to take risks.
My first real hack, I guess, would have been when I was probably a freshman in high school, and the AOL Instant Messenger and MSN was the cool thing. Everybody would get home from school. We had like certain times everybody would get on, and we would dial up our internet, and we would get on these chat rooms, and we would all chat and have a good time and flirt and do the basic young kid thing. You know, like I got to thinking, like, well, I wonder what these girls are talking about, like, that I can't see in their little private group chat. I wonder if they're talking about me, or are they talking about my friend?
And his mind starts working.
So there was a popular virus then. It was called Ice-9. And it was one that you would get infected with quite often. Come to find out, it was just, it had like a back door and a remote access in it to where whoever infected your computer could gain access to your computer.
Ryan kept infecting and reinfecting his computer until he figured out how it worked. And then he reverse engineered it. And finally, he convinced girls in his class to download it.
So I would like send them a message and entice them in some way to run the program on their computer. And then when they ran that program on their computer, I could access their computer like it was my own.
He could see their screens, what they typed, log their keystrokes. He could even see what they were doing when he wasn't at his computer.
And they had no idea.
Then Ryan, naturally, passed the program out to all his friends.
Nobody ever really found out.
His younger sister could never figure out why he knew so much about what she and her friends were up to.
And all along it was because I was, you know, hacking their computers.
Is she going to figure this out now, or has she already figured
it out? Oh, she already knows. She knows. I mean, cat's out of the bag pretty much on all that kind of stuff.
So here's the thing about hacking. There's always another computer system that seems to be beckoning. Some other systems crying out to be broken into. When schools started having online grades, Ryan's friends asked for his help.
Can you hack into the school and change my grade so my parents don't see that I got an F?
Did you do that?
Maybe a time or two.
Then Ryan decided to clone the school's website.
So basically they would log their parents into the school website and say, okay, you can look up my grades. And they look at the grades. And would people pay you for this?
Yeah, so I would sell access to use my system.
What did that cost?
I think it was like $20 a report card.
It was as if Ferris Bueller had started hacking.
First of all, let's talk about the word hacker.
Michael Shamos knows a thing or two about hacking.
For a very long time, it was a term of respect.
And why it's so attractive to young people.
These are people who are right down at the bit level. They were geniuses. They thought in ways that other computer scientists didn't think.
If you think about it, a lot of the kids in his classes have the potential to get drawn into the dark side. Carnegie Mellon has one of the finest computer science programs in the U.S. That's in Pittsburgh.
So my title here at Carnegie Mellon is Distinguished Career Professor.
And now, as a distinguished professor, he knows the moral and legal consequences of black hat hacking and understands the temptation. In fact, he succumbed to it in the 1960s when he was in high school and started programming.
The idea that one could write down a set of instructions and there was this machine that would do your exact bidding, do everything you asked it to do, and of course nothing else. And that gave me, as this little science kid, an incredible sense of entitlement and empowerment.
To put it in adolescent brain terms, for both Ryan and Seamus, computers became a dopamine rush waiting to happen. Seamus and a friend of his had been using computers at Columbia University to work on their programming, but the whole process was too slow. Then they had an idea.
Why don't we see if IBM will let us use their computer?
For free, of course.
The IBM Computer Center on 59th Street. It's no longer there, but it was 59th and Madison, a couple of blocks north of IBM World Headquarters.
It was on street level, and from the sidewalk, you could see refrigerator-sized computers with tape drives spinning like saucers.
And at the time, IBM was charging $900 an hour for computer time.
Right.
During the summer of 1964, my pal and I were down there every day.
Right.
Took the bus downtown and walked in the computer center, and we programmed all kinds of stuff. But we were thinking, how does this all work here?
Back then, those computer punch cards booted up the computer. But Seamus wondered, what was on that punch card that got the IBM 1794, the state-of-the-art computer back then, to come to life? He and his friend noodled around with the cards for weeks, and they discovered that if they changed just one hole, it would create what's called an error condition, and the computer...
Try to read it 10 times and then halt.
Once they understood how to stop one computer, the next question was obvious.
How do we take down the whole computer center?
And the way to do that, they quickly realized, was to mess with the cards. Seamus and his friend quickly moved around the computer room and replaced about 60% of the old cards with new ones. And then they just sat back to watch what happened.
And it was very routine. The operator would notice that the machine had halted, and he would pull out one of these cards from his little bin of cards, stick it in. Normally, it would boot
right.
up.
If he didn't get one of your cards.
Yeah. Yeah, but when he did get one of our cards, he would see the tape would go back and forth 10 times and stop.
So they managed to take down the IBM Computer Center at 59th and Madison just for fun.
I don't even want to say fun.
Okay, just for...
Just because we wanted to see if it would work.
Just to see if it would work.
And the problem was, it wasn't exactly like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, but we then realized that we had taken down the computer center, and at $900 an hour, IBM is losing. Plus, they now have a backlog of work that they can't get through. And we're saying to ourselves, how are we going to fix this?
Because while they were curious about how to take down the computer, they never really thought about what would happen once they had. It was only after panic began to rise in the IBM computer room that it occurred to Seamus that they had made a terrible mistake, so they needed a plan. What they decided to do was leave a good card on the console of the computer and then wait for someone to find it. Eventually, one of the IBM engineers held 2 cards up to the light, one that took the computer down and one that didn't, and he figured out that something was wrong with the card.
And they never knew until this day, and I've never told anybody until this day about it, because I'm sure the statute of limitations has passed by now.
But Seamus has never forgotten it, because it gives him a very special understanding of hackers.
I've studied criminal cases in which people have done things like this. It seems to me that a very high percentage of people who learn how to program computers really do ponder the limits.
And by ponder the limits, he means that young people like Ryan will see how far their abilities can take them without really taking into account what might happen after that. And if we want to catch these kids before they make these kinds of decisions and maybe steer them on a different path, it's important to understand not just how they came to their decisions, but how their brains might be influencing what they're doing. Seamus got lucky. He dabbled in hacking and then stepped back and channeled his energy into something positive. Years after Seamus' stunt, he went to work for, yep, you guessed it, IBM.